Morning. So this morning, I want to talk about a mandala, a whole circle of life, of awakening, of awareness. And I want to start by reading a quote from a Trappist monk. There's a book that I've used before called The Magic Monastery, which is excerpts from interchanges that this Trappist monk had. So here's one of them. An old Trappist monk tells a story about this magic monastery where the true gifts of spiritual life can be found. He says, "I knew there were many interesting sights, but I didn't want any more of the little answers. I wanted the big answer. So I asked the guest master to show me directly to the house of God. I sat myself down, quite willing to wait for the big answer. I remained silent all day, far into the night. I looked him in the eye. I guess he was looking me in the eye. Late at night, I seemed to hear a voice. 'What are you leaving out?' I looked around and I heard it again. 'What are you leaving out?' Was it my imagination? Soon it was all around me, whispering, roaring, 'What are you leaving out? What are you leaving out?' Was I cracking up? I managed to get to my feet and head for the door. I wanted the comfort of a human face or a human voice. Nearby was the corridor where some of the monks live. I knocked on one cell. 'What do you want?' came a sleepy voice. 'What am I leaving out?' 'Me,' he answered. I went to the next door. 'What do you want?' 'What am I leaving out?' 'Me.' A third cell, a fourth, all the same. I thought, they're all stuck on themselves. I left the building in disgust. Just then the sun was coming up. I had never spoken to the sun before, but I heard myself pleading, 'What am I leaving out?' The sun too answered, 'Me.' That finished me. I threw myself on the ground, and the earth said, 'Me too. Me too.'" So, full mandala needs to have all the different parts of our lives. And full mandala, we need to pay attention to the body. We need to pay attention to the emotions. We need to pay attention to the family. We need to pay attention to the community, the Sangha. And we need to pay attention to the natural world. So this is Joseph Cornfield's way of talking about the mandala, but it's based on the old texts. You can find everything in the old texts, but it is based on the old texts. So, I want to talk about those five different areas today a little bit. Starting with body. So sometimes we get so kind of earnest in our practice or ambitious in our lives that we don't take care of body. And you know, we always are sort of checking in and trying to pay better attention to our bodies. But sometimes it's just too hard for us. There is a Buddhist teacher named Joan Tollefson, American Buddhist teacher, who herself was born with no lower arm or hand, I think it was her left side. And she began practicing meditation in her early 20s, but she was never really in touch with her left arm and what was missing and any of that stuff, because she'd grown up in an environment where everybody was quiet when that part of her anatomy came up. The kids were quiet, her teachers were quiet, so she thought it was something not okay. But then in her meditation, at some point, she began to experience really what it was like and what her feelings were, and had the courage to really look at her her disability. So often we don't know. We're leaving stuff out, bodily stuff. So my friend, whom I'll give a fictional name, Dick, used to sit with me in meditation here, many, many years ago, in perfect full lotus. Perfect full lotus. But then he started telling me he was having pains in his knee. And I said, well, gee, I mean, you look so perfect sitting. I think maybe you should try a different posture. He said, no, this is the Buddha way. Well, what happened? He blew out his knee in a sesshin, and he had to have knee surgery because he'd left that part of his body out. He had some idea about the Buddha way, right? Yeah. So we do these kinds of things. And sometimes our Asian meditation teachers haven't actually been that good examples because they were so kind of focused on their practice and on helping people that they didn't pay attention to all aspects of their bodily health. So this is kind of important, I think. Kind of important. Didn't pay attention to their hurts and their limitations. Many of you are familiar with Ram Dass, I think. I think people still know about Ram Dass, don't they? Although I don't hear much about him anymore. I don't know. So I suppose he's still alive. But you know, in 1997, he had this huge stroke. Huge, massive stroke. And he writes about it. Yeah, I heard him speak. Yeah, he came here. He come here. I heard him speak after he had his stroke. And, you know, he could barely speak. He was just trying to get his language back. And he couldn't speak at all. And his body was totally like a pretzel. But everybody was working with him. And he was working with himself. And so here he talks about himself afterwards. For years, I practiced as a karma yogi, the path of service. I wrote books about learning to serve, about how to help others. Now it's reversed. I need people to help me get up and put me to bed. Others feed me and wash my bottom. And I can tell you it's harder to be the one who is helped than the helper. But this is just another stage. It feels like I died and have been reborn over and over. In the 60s, I was a professor at Harvard. And when that ended, I went out with Timothy Leary spreading psychedelics. Then in the 70s, I died from that and returned from India as Baba Ram Dass, the guru. Then in the 80s, my life was all about service, co-founding the Seva Foundation, building hospitals, and working with refugees and prisoners. Over all these years, I played the cello, golf, drove my MG. He came from money. Big money. Since this stroke, the car is in the driveway, the cello and the golf club's in the closet. Now if I think I'm the guy who can't play cello or drive or work in India, I would feel terribly sorry for myself. But I'm not him. During the stroke, I died again, and now I have a new life and a disabled body. This is where I am. And then his famous quote, you've got to be here now. You've got to take the curriculum. Take the curriculum. So our body pretty much tells us what our curriculum is. We may avoid it, but if we do, we're not really enlightened in our body. Regardless of how enlightened we are, we're totally unenlightened in our body. And if we're unenlightened in our body, what is enlightenment about anyway? What's awareness about anyway? What's wakefulness about anyway? So I'm talking to you about this because I need to talk to myself about this. For 2 years, I've been talking to myself about this because of my own body. My own body used to be woohoo body. I didn't sit full lotus, but when my friend's knees went out, my knees didn't go out. I just kept sitting. When my friends had different problems with their back, I never had any problems with my back. I could sit for a long time. Not perfect posture, but still, et cetera, et cetera. I never needed much sleep because Zazen was restful for me. Emptiness. No, I don't need much sleep. for many years. Seemed to be the case. But the last couple of years has not been like that for me. Not been like that for me at all. So I need to wake up to what my body limitations are, to what the hurts are, to what the needs are. Because our body is going anyway. So we may as well appreciate what we have. And we always, while we're alive, there's something going on here to pay attention to. So now, I need to drink water all the time when I'm sitting here. Never forget. Because if I forget to drink water, if I sit for two periods and forget to drink water, I might pass out. And then people will get all freaked out. For me, it's not a big deal, frankly. I just go over and I come back up. But everybody else. And I so much want to teach here, I don't want to freak people out. In my sleep, I got Lyme's disease 2 years ago. Well, since I got Lyme's disease, my immune system has not been... Sometimes it's okay, sometimes it's not okay. And sometimes I just lose all my energy. I don't have any energy. So now I force myself almost or every night to go to bed at 9 or 9:30, maybe 10. No, I still get up at 5, but still... I don't feel sleepy, but I go to bed anyway. Trying to be a good boy. Trying to be a good boy in this body that I was given by the universe for I don't know how many years. We don't know how many years, but we might as well be with it. Be wakeful in it. If there's enlightenment at all, it's right here in this. So if we do that, we begin to just be with what is. Just be with what is, whatever is. And then that's the teaching for us. When I was with my first teacher, we chanted the Heart Sutra twice a day, day after day after day after day. And I've talked about this before. So once I said to him, I'd really like to know what this Heart Sutra means. We chanted in Sino-Japanese with all these funny English words like form, emptiness, topsy-turvy, written underneath. It was his own translation. I said, plus I'm going to bring some college cup friends up here. I really want to know what it means then. It's because I don't want them to think this is just some stupid sort of cult that I belong to. So I asked him in the morning, and I said, will you help me? Will you explain this to me? He said, yeah, sure, later, but look at all the sweeping we have to do. This was in the morning, and we had not very many people in Zazen, a lot of sweeping. So he said, help me with the sweeping. So I helped him with sweeping. But then I thought, he was absent-minded. He seemed to forget all about it. So I came back another time. This time I had, three more friends coming up from college. And we were in the kitchen having breakfast. And I said, now is the time. Just tell me a little bit about it, because they're going to be chanting it, right? And he said, yes, I'll do that later. But look at this kitchen. You need to help me with this kitchen. He said, Oksan's gone. That's his wife. Oksan's gone, and we need to clean up this kitchen. I have a bunch of people coming later. I helped him clean up the kitchen. Then one last time, we were down in Palo Alto where I'd started this little meditation group. And in California, that's where I'm from. And this time, my college friends were there. These were, and I went to Stanford. These were my Stanford friends. And so I said to him, will you talk a little bit about this sutra that we just chanted? And he said, oh, I promised Marion that we would work on her trees outside. They need pruning, and I was hoping you boys would all help me prune them. So then we went out and pruned the trees. This is the whole story, you guys. The teaching is embodied. You embody the teaching. It's nowhere else. It's nowhere else. You want something. We want something. We want something, but here it is. This is it. This is where our desire comes from, right here. Right here. So that's the first section of the mandala, although mandala is multifaceted. So this is just Jack Kornfield's way of dividing them up. Emotions, the second one. Emotions. So it'd be great if we could transcend all that emotional sticky stuff in Zen practice. It'd be great. We'd all like to do that. We maybe think we've done that for a while until something happens. So my first time in a monastic setting, living in California at the Tassajara Zen Monastery, after being there for a few months, I came home with my wife, and I was just flying. I mean, I was flying in that. There was incredible stillness that I saw and I experienced everywhere. It seemed like it just seemed wonderful. Everything. But what happened was, at some point, there was a subtle transition. And the subtle transition was that I began using that at an unconscious level, those feelings of stillness, to be out of touch with my feelings and to be detached. So when my wife would bring stuff up, I would just kind of withdraw. I didn't even know I was withdrawing. But my dad knew how to withdraw, and he never did Zazen, so I learned this at an early age, right? But I didn't know it. I thought this was just the wonderful detachment of meditation. So be careful. Be careful. Our emotions are here. They're always going to come up. All kinds of emotions. Emotions you never expected to come up. So honor them and be with them. The awakened heart is undefended. And the Chuangtsu, the Taoist teacher that we're going to be studying in later in the spring, said the 10,000 joys and sorrows are the Tao itself. The 10,000 joys and sorrows. So when Ram Dass was asked, after he'd been practicing for years, before he had his stroke, if he transformed his personality, he laughed and said he'd become a connoisseur of his neuroses. A connoisseur. Maybe you don't want to become a connoisseur of your neuroses. I know you don't, but this is good. Become a connoisseur of your neuroses. That's much better than some fake transcendence. That fake transcendence will be okay for a while till something happens. It'll be okay. Oh, maybe it's real transcendence, but what's real? So after I had been practicing for a while more, the first time I went to the monastery at Tassajara, then I came back home. Then I went a second time, this time without my wife, and lived there for a while. And this time, this was the next year, well, I was dismayed to see that my transcendence had gone away. That I was just really reacting to everybody's feelings. And that the deeper my zazen got, the more I felt, oh, I hurt that person. Oh, I didn't take care of this. Oh. Da 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 da. So I went to my teacher again. You know that helpful teacher who helped me about my body, when helped me about the Heart Sutra. You know, I finally didn't even begin to learn what the Heart Sutra meant till I came here to Minnesota. It actually has a lot of interesting meaning. But first things first. First things first. The Heart Sutra is an expression of something that happens. That a way we experience the world when we are really in it, not out of it, but in it. So anyway, I went to Suzuki Roshi and Doksan in Tassajara that second time, that second practice period in the winter, many years ago, and I said, oh, it was almost like I was mad at him, because here I've been practicing for all these years, and I had all this calmness. And yet I was as actually more sensitive to emotions than I had been before. More sensitive to mine and others. And more sensitive to the fact that I was hurting people, that I was being kind of an asshole sometimes. Yeah, more than sometimes. And so I went and I just poured it out the way sometimes people used to do with Katagiri Roshi and Suzuki Roshi. Just poured it out. And he said, "Oh, I know exactly what you mean. Oh," he said, "it's like that for me too." He said, "Now that my practice is deepening," he said this to me, "now that my practice is deepening, now that his practice is deepening," I thought he was a Zen master beyond compare, right? "Oh, now that my practice is deepening, I notice when I do something that is hurtful, and I think, oh, that's awful, that's awful. So what could I say but go back to the Sento, but go back to the work? What could I say?" I always wondered if he thought about, he was trying to be clever when he did those things. But he never seemed to be very clever. He was just sort of expressing how he was. Never seemed like a very clever person. So, there's this guy, Maury Schwartz, who wrote, what is it, Tuesdays at Maury's. I read a little bit of this book once. Did any of you read that book? Tuesdays at Maury's, I think. And he says, he's got Lou Gehrig's disease. He's in the hospital. He's dying. And he talks to his student. He was a professor at Brandeis, and he had a lot of students. So students stayed with him, and he hung out with him. So here he is. He's dying. He talks to his student. "What I'm doing now," he continued, his eyes still closed, "is detaching myself from the experience." "Detaching yourself," I said. "Yes, detaching myself. You know what the Buddhists say, don't cling to things, because everything is impermanent." "But wait," I said, "aren't you always talking about experiencing life, Maury? All the good emotions, all the bad ones? How can you do that if you're detached?" "Detachment doesn't mean don't let the experience penetrate you," he said. "On the contrary, you let it penetrate you fully. That's how you're able to leave it." "I'm lost." "Take any emotion, love for a woman, or grief for a loved one, or what I'm going through, fear and pain from a deadly illness. If you hold back on the emotions, if you don't allow yourself to go all the way through them, you can never get to be detached. You're too busy being afraid. You're afraid of the pain, you're afraid of the grief, you're afraid of the vulnerability that loving entails. But by throwing yourself into these emotions, by allowing yourself to dive in all the way, over your head even, you experience them fully and completely. You know what pain is. You know what love is. You know what grief is. And only then can you say, all right, I've experienced that emotion. I can recognize that emotion. Now I'm free to detach from that emotion for a moment. I know you think this is just about dying, but it's like I keep telling you, when you learn how to die, you learn how to live. So that's the second area, emotions. Second area for us to be just wakeful with, whatever comes up. We don't know what's going to come up. And we can transcend it, but not for long. And is it really alive, or is it sort of a dead transcendence? If life doesn't come from emotion, from feeling, where does it come from? So the third one, family. Third aspect of the mandala that we leave out. Family. So, you know, it's easier, so much easier for most of us to practice for all beings than it is for our family. Oh, yes, I'm the great bodhisattva. I go to work every day, help people with mental illness. I come here and I do Dokusan. But my family, my wife, my parents, my kids, oh, my kids maybe. It's hard. It's hard. So we want to leave family out. I mean, we don't want to, but we do leave family out. We do. We compartmentalize. So Buddha, you know, left his home. He came back after his enlightenment as a beggar, right? And his father rebuked him for being unseemly, for just going around begging. Why do you come to my house and beg? And Matsa, the famous Chinese teacher, says, you can't teach in your native town because they only know you by your childhood names. You can never teach in your native town. I'm not teaching in my native town. I'm far, far away from my native town. So I have a friend who's I practiced with in California when I was young. And later she married a guy who was an American who has a Korean Zen teacher. And my friend's husband went to Korea to practice I think he was there 9 months practicing in Korea. And he came back, and my friend and I kind of correspond sometimes. And she wrote me about Ken, and she said, this was before we were doing email, so this was maybe 7 or 8 years ago. And she said, I said, well, Ken's back. How's he doing? And she said, well, you know, he's been back for a year now, Tim. Well, I lose track of time, so a year. Oh, I said, oh, well, I'm glad. I'm glad he's back, and I'm glad you guys are together still. I didn't think they wouldn't be together, but so many of my friends from the early days in California, they didn't stay with their partners. In fact, almost none of them did, but they stayed together. And she said in her little note to me, well, Ken came home from Korea in an amazing state. He was enlightened for 6 months. I thought, oh, that's wonderful. She said, until he spent time with his mom. That's what my friend Sheridan wrote me. He was enlightened for 6 months until he spent time with his mom. If you're not chuckling, you better look at your life a little more closely, please. Look at your life a little more closely. You should be either chuckling or crying at this point. So most of us have to go through some family healing. We have to. Families are tough. And you know, we used to say in the old days, that's a dysfunctional family, that's a dysfunctional family, this is a dysfunctional family. But then, what's the meaning of the word dysfunctional? If they're all dysfunctional families, they're just families. Why do you even need that word dysfunctional? Everybody wants to find the functional family. Oh, come on. Come on, grow up, grow up, grow up. So when I was young, I was got a little bit of training as a family therapist. And I was trained in the Salvador Minuchin style of family therapy. And Salvador Minuchin talks about enmeshment and disengagement. And he says one is the mirror image of the other in a family. In dysfunctional families, people are either enmeshed or disengaged, or they move between being enmeshed and disengaged. And you know, enmeshment is when you can't have your own voice, or when it has to be the whole family. It has to be the dad or the mom, and you don't feel like you can be your own self. That's enmeshment. And then engagement is the opposite, when you just shut down. You just leave emotionally or leave literally. But the middle way, which Salvador Minuchin didn't know about in Buddhism, is engage. Just engage. Just right here. Just right here. So in my own family, I've been through all these things. And I can't say it's over, although it's over with my parents because they're dead. Well, my father's not quite dead, but he might as well be dead. But still, I carry it. Even though it's over, it's not over. We carry it. And so one of the reasons I'm in Minnesota was because I disengaged. I disengaged from my family, from my family of origin. My wife and I both did. I mean, we didn't know we were coming out here to disengage, but I think we were, partly. Yeah, I think we were, and we didn't even know it. Because we fell under too much pressure to conform, our families had different values than us, all that stuff, right? So after I'd been out here for a while, my father wasn't speaking to me anymore. He decided, well, he already wasn't speaking to me, but then when I decided to come from California to Minnesota, somehow he took it as a personal insult that I would leave beautiful California for Minnesota. And I thought, oh, fine, you know, I don't need him. But you know, we only have one father, one mother. We only have a few siblings. If we don't aren't in family, who are we with? And then we carry around that sense of brokenness, of being cut off in that disengaged kind of way. So I worked for a long time on trying to reach out to my dad. And I had some success. You know, when I was working on this, I hung out with a Zen monk from Japan a little bit. Not Katagiri Roshi, because Katagiri Roshi had a family and he knew about all this stuff. But this Buddhist monk said to me, well, we don't know about your practice because we're monks. When I was talking to him about family issues, we don't know about it. You're monks. And I said, oh, okay. But you know, what's monastic practice about? Monastic practice is about renunciation. It's about patience. It's about steadiness. It's about generosity. So, my work with my father, I really had to work on renunciation. I had to just renounce completely the desire that he was ever going to get this Zen stuff or have any interest in it or feel favorable toward it at all or want to talk about it or want to even acknowledge that I was doing it. It was a big renunciation for me. And I used to try. And then I thought, no, this is renunciation. But it was hard. Renunciation is hard. But if you want to engage, sometimes you have to renounce. You have to renounce something to engage. And I had to be patient about my own reactivity. My own reactivity to my own father's values. God, where did he get those values? You know, yuck. You know, Reagan is too liberal for him. Yeah. You know, really. So I had to be patient with my own reactivity. If I'm not patient with my own reactivity, I disengage. I'm out of there. But there I am. Well, always reacting. You know, my dad is not quite dead yet, but if he said something, if he got out of that nursing home bed and said something like, oh, you know, those damn liberals, Bush and those other damn liberals, then my reaction would come up, right? I have to be patient. You have to be patient with your reactivity if you're going to be on this path, if you're going to be open to this path of awakening. Steadiness, the monastic steadiness, zazen every morning, zazen every night. But what about trying over and over with your family? The same thing, the same kind of steadiness. Bringing it back. Call my dad on the phone every week. Every week. Sometimes he'll talk about the weather. Sometimes he'll go a little beyond the weather. Sometimes he won't talk at all. This was 20 years ago. My father can't talk anymore, but this is when I was working on the relationship. Steadiness. If we're steady, we connect. And if we connect, we discover the connection has always been here. But that monastic practice, right in family, steadiness. And generosity. We have to have generosity of spirit in our relationships of intimacy because we see their shadow so big time. our spouse, our parents. It's just in our face all the time. And we forget. We forget that there's some connection there. That she gave birth to me. I married her. He took me to camp every summer and bought me a car and taught me how to ski. Well, generosity of spirit. So, monastic practice, family practice, there's no difference. No difference. Sometimes we want to run away for family practice to monastic practice. Sometimes we want to run away from monastic practice to family practice. Good luck. It's just the world. It's just life, you guys. So, we have a task before us in family practice. Can we stay true to our core values and at the same time be open and vulnerable and engaged with those family members who may or may not share those? Can we do that? That might be the middle way. It could be. Could be. And the fourth aspect of the mandala, community. Community. Sangha, as we say in Buddhist circles. And of course, here in the United States, we atomize. We have each child has his or her own bedroom. Each employee has his or her own cubicle. Each family member has their own car. And these days, each kid has their own TV, so they don't have to argue about TV shows. So we're not great on community as a culture. We're not great. And we had a Chinese guy living with us for a while, and I asked him what he thought the deficits were of our culture after he'd been with us for about a year. And he said, first of all, he just listed them. First, he would say, well, first of all, his name was Ronan. He was a graduate student at University of Minnesota. He said, first of all, children don't respect their parents. Well, he'd been with me, my wife and me and our kids for a year. Children don't respect their parents. Well, I just thought it was normal, but for him, no. And I said, and second, he said, oh, you don't know about community. You Americans don't know about community. And I have an Indian daughter-in-law now. Boy, do I see community when I hang out with the Indians. Boy, do I see it. I see my daughter and son-in-law got married in Milwaukee, and Seema wanted to introduce me to all her cousins. Well, none of these women are her blood cousins. She introduced me to 150 people. They're all her cousins. I mean, she feels that way. So American culture, this is not our strength. Not our strength. So Sangha is a little bit hard for us. A little hard for us to generate Sangha, to put up with each other's idiosyncrasies and to extend. And of course, in Buddha's time, even his cousin tried to murder him. And when Buddha lived with a bunch of his monks for a while, he had a place called Kosambi. They're being so obstinate that he decided to leave them. But he came back because community, Sangha. Sangha. So Joseph Kornfield suggests that communal practice, is like putting potatoes in the pot and spinning the potatoes to rub off the peels. I never saw that happen, but that's kind of an interesting analogy, I guess. And we certainly experience this in Zen practice when we practice together, when we do a retreat especially. We come up against each other's stuff. And whenever we try to establish community, we do this. I was part of the communal movement years ago, and it was a failure because we couldn't just seem to accept each other's idiosyncrasies. So we went back to our monads. We went back to our atomized lives. You don't see too many of those intentional communities left anymore in the United States. It's kind of sad. But Sangha is intentional community. That's what it is. And so, in the Buddhist world, and it's still very, very important. And I think in the human world. One of the communities that I've talked about before is a community of people who live outside. That I spent some time with these people. And these are not the people, these are the people who live under bridges and in homeless camps. And most of them don't live in shelters because in shelters they're anonymous. In shelters there's no sense of community. In shelters there's a sense that they're just guests and they could get moved around. But when they live out in these homeless camps, they develop their community. They look out for each other. Protect each other. So community is really important to all of us. All beings, all human beings. Americans just struggle with that for some reason. So when Ram Dass went to see his guru, Neem Karoli Baba, and asked, "How can I be enlightened?" Baba answered, "Love people, feed people, love people." And he went back and talked to him again. I don't know whether it's always these three things. And Suzuki Roshi did that with me too, these three things. He went back to him and he said, "But what's the best path to awakening?" And what did Baba say? "Feed people, love people, feed people." He went back and he tried to work on establishing some community. Came back to the United States, but it failed. He went back to see Baba again. He said, "But what's the best technique for establishing community?" And Baba said, "Love people, feed people, love people." Community. Intimacy with all life is what Dogen would say. Intimacy with all life. And if we don't start with each other, then if we leave that all out of our all life, then where is our all life? So finally, the last section of the mandala, natural world, intimacy, awakefulness to the natural world. Gary Snyder. Gary Snyder is a good person to read about when you think about the natural world. I think, at least. The real work is becoming native in your heart. Come, you understand we really live here, that this is really the continent we're on, and that our loyalties are here, to these mountains and rivers, to these plant zones, to these creatures. The real work involves a loyalty that goes back billions of years. The real work is accepting citizenship in the earth itself. So Buddha gave his first sermon. He didn't go to the city. He gave it in Deer Park. Jesus spent time in the desert. That's where he prayed. He went to the sea. He went to the ocean. Dogen, he got Dharma transmission in urban Japan. Urban Japan, 13th century urban Japan. Anyway, he got Dharma transition there, but he had to go to China. Way into the mountains to really find something precious. He had to join the natural world. When he came back, he had disciples who wanted him to set up something in the city. He went out again, way far away into nature to set up what was a Heiji. Now it's a big tourist place. Then it was way far away. Way far away. And then he wrote about mountains and rivers. The voice of Buddha, the voice of life. So a last quote here. So there's a bunch of guys working in a stone yard in England. And they're continuing to add towers on a nearby building, which is on the edge of a beautiful natural environment, as they have for centuries. And this fellow asks one workman what he was doing. The workman replied wearily, "My job is to square off the stones and move them." When he asked a second fellow, "What are you doing?" he replied, "I'm a stone cutter, working so I can care for my wife and children and feed my family." A third man performing the identical labor looked up joyfully and answered, "I'm building a great cathedral." I'm building a great cathedral. So when we can see that the earth is our cathedral, then we can open up to a great happiness, a great happiness. And here we are by Lake Calhoun. Here we are. Wonderful. Natural lake. One side, beautiful yard on the other side that people have been taking care of. There's our chance to wake up. Gandhi said, "One cannot do right in one department of life while still occupied in doing wrong in any other department." So, our body, our emotions, our family, our community, regardless of how small or large it is, whatever community you commit yourself to, and the natural world, the whole mandala. That's what I want to say. That's what I want to be with you. That's what I want to practice with you, just being the mandala that we already are. Reminding each other when we forget certain parts of it. Just gently reminding each other. Questions? Comments? Well, I think that's good. I think could you guys hear what he said? I think what you're saying is healthy. I think what you're saying is healthy. The automatic kind of, I mean, we do so much of our living as automatons, and I don't think we really appreciate a family member until we've stepped away from that habitual stimulus and response, interaction, because that habitual stuff isn't the dynamic part of family. That's not engaged. In a way, that's a kind of low-level enmeshment. It's not the enmeshment that I was talking about, but it's a low-level enmeshment. Do you know what I mean? So I think we need to step away and look, and then choose. And so I think what you're talking about is really healthy.
Can I add to that?
Yeah.
So how can parents help their kids to get a sense of choice? maybe your parents say, well, sometimes this is going on in our family, we realize that maybe that's already a step in the right direction, but what else would be?
Well, I think the problem is that if a parent feels that his child has to be a certain way to be okay, maybe often the parent doesn't feel okay unless his child is a certain way, then you can't. So the parent has to do their own work so they don't have to have the child be a certain way to be okay themselves. And if they do their own work, if they do this work, that I think they can then begin to just appreciate the child's personhood as it is, because they don't need the child to be a certain way. That's what I think. What do you think?
It's really difficult, though. You know, you heard the Chinese students say, well, children don't respect them.
Yes.
His parents would have said, oh, it's okay, little Reggie or whatever, doesn't respect us. We'll just love them anyway. You know, then maybe... I mean, there are consequences to that may be selfish, or they may not actually be so selfish to not enforcing certain expectations. It's easier said than done in other
words. Yeah, and of course we have to have, we need to set expectations for our children too, so there's no, we do need to set expectations for our children, our spouse, ourselves. I mean, this is a world where we don't have expectations. We don't have an enduring relationship. So there's, I don't think there's a right answer here. But I think the more we get awake to the mandala ourselves and the different parts of it ourselves, the more we just don't oppress. We don't oppress our children because we don't feel oppressed. But if I hadn't worked on those issues with my dad and sat while I was doing that too, kept my sitting going, I'm sure I would have passed that stuff down to my kids. But I probably did some anyway, you know. But that's okay. I mean, that's life. But at least I was aware. At least I was conscious and available to my own inadequacies and to theirs.
Can I add something?
Sure.
So I think too, in terms of when it's appropriate for whatever age, to give them the space to make some choices that you don't want them to maybe be selfish about things, but maybe they pick out what they eat for lunch or bring to school, to give
anything else? Can you speak a little louder?
I have something to add too. I think it's important that parents tell their children that they respect them. That they respect them and their choices and the difficulties they might have in their lives. And I think that provides a real opening for communication. And it's really the foundation. Especially when they're young. And that supports differentiation because you're relating to them as a separate human being emotionally. You're not fused with them emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of key, is the emotional enmeshment.
Yep. I didn't know we were going to get into child raising, but you never know where this is going to go. Anything else? Okay.